Sun is shining. Wind is from the southwest at 15. 44 degrees Racine, 42 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming award-winning author Peter Annan Wednesday evening, April 24th. He will present the inaugural lecture in the Gunderson Lecture Series titled Great Lakes Water Tension in the 21st Century. Annan will discuss the challenges we face regarding sustainable water practices. A reception and book signing to follow. This event is free and open to the public. Details available at carthage.edu/Gunderson. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We are celebrating an anniversary today, and this is the anniversary of an organization that you may or may not have heard of. I have heard of it because I've had the pleasure of singing on a number of occasions at some events sponsored by PEO. And those letters, I understand, stand for Philanthropic Educational Association, organization, the Philanthropic Educational Organization. And PEO has been around for 150 years, began in very modest circumstances from a group of just seven women in Mount Pleasant, Iowa, who wanted to further themselves, wanted to further their own educational aspirations, and wanted to do so for other women as well. And for 150 years, that has been happening, to the point now where there are 6,000 chapters of PEO across the country, including a number of different chapters right here in southeastern Wisconsin. And here to tell the PEO story today in our studios, first of all, Teddy Winnett, who is the current president of one of the local chapters of PEO, and then Nancy Ritana, who is a PEO project recipient as well as a member of the organization. So she would be an example of a young woman who has received support and help in the form of tangible resources to further her own educational career. And so I'm very excited to have this opportunity to speak with both of these women about their participation in PEO and what this organization has meant to them and to others. Teddy Winnett and Nancy Ritana, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you very much for having us.
Good to have you here. And I do want to also say that my good friend Lois Van Damme has been an active member of PEO for many, many years, and she is actually the first person who approached me saying that it was this banner anniversary year for the organization and that a morning show devoted to PEO was a good idea. And I could not agree more. So my thanks to Lois, who I hope is listening, and my thanks to her for having this great idea and helping to bring it to fruition. So, Teddy Winnett, beyond my brief introductory comments, what else do you think is important for our listeners to know right off the bat about PEO?
Well, our focus has historically always been about women. I like to frame it as those seven founding sisters who themselves were recognized as women ahead of their time, having been afforded an opportunity to be in college at that point in their lives, recognized that they need to support one another and provide future opportunities for other women to follow them. So our mission to me is so empowering, and one of the reasons why I've been a member as long as I have. And it's a simple mission. We celebrate advancement of women. We educate women through our scholarships and grants and loan programs, as well as a college that we own in Nevada, Missouri called Cottey College. And lastly, we motivate. We motivate women to really achieve to their greatest potential and be the best that they can be. Mm. So real simply, we're women working and supporting other women.
Mm. What can you tell us about these seven women who actually created this organization 150 years ago in Mount Pleasant, Iowa? And I want to add parenthetically that I grew up in Iowa, and I was just reminded the other night when I saw a wonderful play called Leaving Iowa that one of the little fun facts that was shared is that Iowa has the highest literacy rate in the country, and it's had that distinction for many, many years. And I remember hearing that and feeling a great sense of pride. I think a lot of the country would not guess that Iowa would have that distinction, but it indeed does. And so in some ways, it makes perfect sense that Iowa might be the place where an organization like this might come into being. Tell us more about at least whatever we know about the genesis of this and about these seven women.
Well, fortunately for an organization as old as we are, we do know quite a bit about the Seven Sisters because they were very meticulous about keeping the history and making sure to record how they began and how this started. And so it's really as a result of a situation that they found themselves in as friends here at Iowa Wesleyan. And that was that they... a few of them had been invited to become a member of another sorority that was forming on campus. But this group of seven women were very close and very tight. And because not all seven of them received the invitation, they made the decision, you know, we should probably just do something ourselves. Mm. And so that friendship that they had forged encouraged them to create their own version of a women's society to support other women who would be able to have opportunities to get an education as they were receiving there at Iowa Wesleyan. Now, these were women on campus who were themselves leaders and in the forefront of helping make change, revolutionary change for their time. And so when they got together to decide how to do this, they started out in almost a secret way, if you will, because they didn't want the other group that had started to form to realize what they were doing. Mm. So it was one of this little, let's just put all of our eggs over here and start making our plans, and then we'll come out and announce what we're doing. Mm. So that's kind of how, that's actually how they started. They actually say it happened in the music room of Main Hall at Iowa Wesleyan University in 1869. And those seven women are granted the very historical perspective of setting us off on that path to figure out how to support women who wanted to get an education to further themselves. But related to that, how do we financially give them the means to do so in a way that allow them to be able to fully engage in that education and support themselves.
Right.
So,
one of the things that intrigues me about that great story is that PEO formed at a time when the women's suffrage movement was, to some extent, gaining steam. But, of course, this is still decades before women were ultimately granted the vote. I just wonder, as you look back over the early history of the organization, do we see any parallels or crossover? Was the matter of women's suffrage at all a part of the mission of PEO, or did they try to keep themselves, in a sense, distinct from that other venture?
Very much a part of that evolutionary change. Very much so. Many of them go on to teach school and to find themselves active in the communities where they resettle after getting their degrees, in working very much in all issues related to women and women's issues with families. So our history very specifically identifies some of the very moving accomplishments that they've made in each of the areas in which they've all pursued. And for the seven women, we have today descendants of some of their family members who still stay connected and are carrying on much of that very commitment and support and just whatever they need to do to make sure things change in the direction to move things forward.
Wow. What can you tell us about the growth of PEO? We've already said, and I just find this so amazing and wonderful, that it started with these seven women meeting in secret, you say, in the music room of the main building of Iowa Wesleyan. Can you give us some sense of how quickly this organization grew beyond those modest beginnings?
I would say that it's probably one of those that it spreads primarily by word of mouth. And so as that happens, it's almost just a natural communities gain chapter members. Those chapter members move away and move to another location, who then start pursuing like interests with women with whom they associate with. So it starts to, shall we just say, spread. No surprise that most of the chapters, or many, many, many chapters, are here in the Midwest, around Iowa and Illinois, Wisconsin, Indiana. But there are 230,000 members across Canada and the United States, which, by the way, is why we get to call ourselves PEO International, because it's also in Canada, the Canadian provinces. We have... I believe, I'm trying to remind myself how many chapters or we have in the state of Wisconsin. I should know that off the top of my head, but I don't at the moment.
But there's like half a dozen right here in southeastern Wisconsin, I think.
Absolutely. Just in Kenosha, Racine alone, we have 8 chapters in Kenosha and Racine. So we have, certainly 12 to 24 probably here in southeast Wisconsin. Yeah.
Wow.
Very much.
One of the things that intrigues me about a group that has been around this long is that the world changes and the country changes and laws change and so on. And, of course, at some point through the course of these 150 years, life began to change quite dramatically for women. As you look back over the history of PEO, do you see any kind of shift in emphasis? Or by and large has kind of its central goal from the start remained largely unchanged?
That's a great question, Greg. I think by and large the goal is the same. If I see any changes, I would say it's more related to the geographic reach of women that we want to support. So, you know, early in our history, it was probably just those very honored women who had an opportunity to go to college and further their education. As more women get that opportunity, then it's expanded to women who are then acquiring an advanced degree. So then we're supporting women going after master's and PhD work. We then get a very international connection by our willingness and desire to support women who are trying to make change in their countries. So we have several projects that are focused on women working in their own international countries, either going to school here in the United States, getting an education to take back to their home countries, or we're supporting women in their countries doing the great work that they're doing.
Wow.
So I think the scope is still very germane to the idea of women making a difference and educating themselves to be able to do that in a way that gain respect and notoriety. But the way we've done it has been slowly over these 150 years by increasing the scope and the number of projects financially that we're supporting to allow women to accomplish that.
Wow. It's kind of fun to think about what those seven women in Mount Pleasant, Iowa would even make of such a notion. I suspect the idea never even crossed their minds that what they were creating, first of all, would live on 150 years beyond them, but also that it would also grow beyond little Mount Pleasant, Iowa, to be the kind of organization it is today. It must be gratifying to you who are part of it now to think about that.
It really is. It's very rewarding, and it's always rewarding when we are in situations where we have a chance to meet women who have been the recipients of our project money, or even in a very sort of much more local way, if we're able to identify a young woman or a woman of any age, actually, who is finding themselves struggling with trying to accomplish the financial means to acquire their education, and we can do even the smallest things by helping support them with their books or with childcare so they can attend class. And you see as a result of that, once they've achieved that goal, just the appreciation and the desire to give back again for themselves to say, how do I make this, how do I keep this going? And that's probably been one of, I would guess, the unspoken secrets of why it's lasted 150 years, is that those of us who have been fortunate enough to receive an education and or financial assistance to do so want others to also have that benefit. So it's always looking back and saying, I was able to achieve this. I want others to be able to have the same opportunities. And so you work hard to be able to make that happen. Mm.
For those of you just joining us, we are talking today on the morning show about an organization called PEO, the Philanthropic Educational Organization. And this is a sisterhood of women, and it has been around 150 years. It began in the most modest of circumstances, seven women in Mount Pleasant, Iowa, at Iowa Wesleyan College, pledging to work together to not only further themselves, but also try to help other women to enjoy the opportunities that they had to receive an education and pursue their highest dreams. And PEO has now grown to be an international organization, and with 6,000 different chapters in the United States. With us today, Teddy Winnett, who is the current president of one of the local chapters of PEO. And also with us is Nancy Ratana, who is a PEO member and a project recipient. And Nancy, it's time for us to talk with you because of what Teddy Winnett was just saying in terms of the goal of PEO to make a difference in the lives of various women. It sounds like you are one of those young women who have benefited from what PEO does. Tell us a little bit about what you have received from them.
Yep. Yes. So last year in 2018, I was actually a recipient for the Continuing Education Scholarship through PEO, and this requires that a member actually recruit you for the scholarship, talk to the sisters about your background, and then they met with me formally, and then they all decided that I was a worthwhile candidate and submitted a letter on my behalf to the main organization office, which I believe is in
Des Moines.
So Teddy was actually my boss at Kenosha County UW Extension when I worked there, when I was working there 2 years ago. So I have that indirect tie. And then I received the scholarship last January, and then I was invited to become a member as well last year. So then I became a member, and then during initiation, I saw Lori Pascucci, who, it turns out, she was actually my fifth grade teacher at Southport Elementary School.
Ah.
So that was very interesting. It's great fun. She was one of my favorite teachers, actually, and I'm not just saying that. she actually was, and my parents, like, she's the one that my parents often remember. So, yeah, now it's just been funny how she was my teacher once, and now we're sisters in this organization. So it's just been a great, worthwhile experience.
Fantastic. So, Teddy Winnett, tell us what prompted you to reach out to Nancy and why you thought this would be a worthwhile opportunity for her.
Well, Nancy is a remarkable young woman, and having worked with her, I could see such potential in her as a young professional willing to jump in and work very hard and do whatever it took to get the job done. When she shared with me that she was contemplating going back to get a master's degree, I thought, oh my goodness, what a great opportunity for her professionally and personally. This is just great. You need to do this. I encourage you. And I recognize that it's probably also going to be a bit of a financial challenge, as it is for many of us, to pursue our education. And so without prying too much, I just simply, you know, ask simple questions to find out if, you know, were you lucky enough to win the lottery and you have it all paid for, or do you have a beneficiary here? And we got to talking, and I said, you know, Nancy, I belong to a women's organization that I think might be able to assist you. and let me tell you more about it. And so the more I told Nancy, the more excited she got and the more interested she got. So as I saw her enthusiasm grow for this, in my own mind, I'm thinking, my goodness, not only do we have a recipient, I think I have a new sister here. I'm going to be able to recruit her to become a member of our local chapter. And so that's how we did it. And I couldn't be more proud of Nancy and the work that she's done, but also knowing that the hard work we do to raise the funds is actually being, again, utilized and the beneficiary of someone who will give right back here in the Kenosha community, which is just a wonderful, wonderful thing to have happen.
That's exactly what it's all about. So what was it, Nancy, that you wanted to do in terms of pursuing further education? What field were you wanting to enter, or what were you seeking in gaining more education? Yep.
So when I started with the county again, actually as an undergrad at Carthage College, I interned with the Kenosha County Health Department. So then I got exposed to the public sector work and all the good that comes out of that. And I got really interested in it. I graduated and worked at UW Parkside for 2 years. So I got exposed to that kind of state type of government. Mm-hmm. And then I went and started working under Teddy with Kenosha County UW Extension. And then there working with a variety of different programs, not only with Extension, but with the Parks Department, Public Works and whatnot. And I got exposed to a variety of different things with grant writing, program development, communications. And I really became more passionate about public work and public service. And I see myself as a public servant that, you know, I just love working with the community, love, you know, doing outreach and education and whatnot. So I feel like local government is a great place to be working. You have through that first arm for the community. And so in further thinking, I've always wanted to go back to school, get the master's degree. I'm a first generation, oldest child of five, you know. Education has always been an important component for us. So I was just thinking, okay, what do I want to do? Further looked into the master's in public administration with UW-Milwaukee. And it's been a great program. The professors, they're just experts in the field. Small class sizes, you know, very intimate. You really get to know the professor, and the work is just like parallel or overlapping with my work with the county. So I've been very fortunate under Teddy. I believe I started classes under you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I did start classes under Teddy, and then she retired. So then I have kept on going full-time, working full-time as well in the county, and everyone else has been very supportive with me. So master's in public administration is what I'm going for. I'll be graduating at the end of this fall, actually. So I've been going straight for the 2 years.
Wow, very good. Mm-hmm. And it's been everything that you wanted it to be from the sounds of it.
Yeah.
Teddy, when PEO is thinking about dispersing scholarship funds to somebody like Nancy, what kinds of things end up being weighed? What is typically the criteria by which you extend help to a woman seeking education?
Well, we actually have conversations about what it is they're trying to achieve in terms of a degree and how long is it going to take them. Given that we have six different projects that provide financial support, they each have a different level of criteria and accountability. So in some cases, it may be, for example, one of our projects is for a woman who has had a gap in their education. So perhaps they started, have had to step away for whatever reason, as life happens, I like to say, and then they need to go back. So it's that then it allows them to be eligible for that particular project. In Nancy's case, she was eligible for the program of continuing education, and she has to disclose her financial status. And though as chapter members, that's not privy to us, the applications are all sent to our international headquarters in Des Moines and reviewed by third parties, if you will. So all the chapters across the United States and Canada who find eligible women, as we did with Nancy, submit those applications, and then they're vetted and all the research is done and the determination of how much they'll be awarded. And the process sounds cumbersome, but to our surprise and delight, it happens very quickly. So they do this on a rolling basis through several times during the year so that we're able to keep that process moving and allow that money to continue to flow so folks like Nancy don't have to wait and wonder, am I going to have enough money to be able to pay tuition? So it works out well.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And I imagine that the day you found out that your application was successful and you were a recipient of this help was a very happy day for you indeed.
I was ecstatic. And like Teddy said, I learned pretty quickly. They submitted the application maybe a 4-week wait, and then I found out. And it was great because I had just started the semester, or was about to start the semester, so helped with books and tuition costs.
Right. So you could do that knowing that there was at least a little bit of cushion, and
yes.
That makes all the difference when you're pursuing something like this. And on top of it, working full-time at the mm-hmm. same time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a terrific story, and we're glad that PEO has made such a positive difference in your life. That's absolutely great. So Teddy Winnett, where does the money come from?
From the efforts of PEO chapters all over Canada and the United States, and that'll be in a variety of formats. Probably one of our biggest challenges is the creative ways to continue to figure out how to raise revenue to send back to Des Moines. Our local chapter here in Kenosha, one of our primary fundraising events is a rummage sale that we do at the home of one of our members who live in a condo complex where the whole condo complex has a Saturday of everything's a rummage sale.
Ah.
And so then we contribute items from our own personal homes to sell, and all of that money then benefits the chapter. And we've been doing this now consistently for probably almost 12 to 15 years, that we have many individuals return and say, I remember coming to this last year, and I love that you're doing this to give educational awards to women. So maybe we're getting a little recognition in a roundabout way for others to support the efforts that we're doing. We've also sold different variety of items. You know, you think of every nonprofit in everywhere you go in any community is looking for ways to raise money. There are a variety of alternative ways chapters here in Southeast Wisconsin may hold events. They sell, as I say, they sell products. They might hold a musical event. We do whatever we can to raise funds to then send back. And we actually pledge a commitment to how much we will give every year to support the projects. And then annually that's all compiled by state and then obviously by the entire United States to see how much money we've given over the years. And I'm happy to say that we have supported more than 105,000 women with over $320 million with educational assistance.
Wow, that's a lot of rummage sales. That's terrific. That's absolutely terrific. When you gather, I'm assuming that it is not just for the sake of planning your next rummage sale, but I suspect that there is, in a sense, more to it in terms of when you come together as sisters. What typically happens at PEO meetings?
Another great question. A couple of things. One is we often have a focus on our own projects. So we have members in our organization who are referred to as the project chairwoman of each of these projects. And their responsibility is to monitor and oversee what's happening with each of the projects so they can report back to us internationally and nationally what's happening, as well as helping all of us, reminding each of us what the criteria is for these particular projects. So when we're out and about and we meet women or come across women who know other women, to remind them that we are a resource to support their financial needs. So we're constantly updating ourselves all the time. And with six projects, we often get confused about which project supports which endeavors, and so we're always needing to be reminded. A second component is learning about and supporting the Kenosha community.
Mm.
So, for example, our program last month was having two deputy sheriffs from the Kenosha County Sheriff's Department speak to us on consumer fraud and scams.
Mm.
Which is a hot topic for any of us who do anything electronically, which is about all of us, correct? So it's a way in which we continue to get education for ourselves, to support ourselves learning, but also learning more about our local community. Every year, we also try to support a local nonprofit. Last year, we all went together and went to see one of the productions of Lakeside Players at the Rohde Center for the Arts. We might do something for the Kenosha Literacy Council, or we're learning more about the Boys and Girls Club. So we're constantly trying to also be connected to the community and support their efforts, as well as inviting them to learn more about what we do so that they can also help spread the word and let people know that we're an organization that supports women achieving that educational goal.
Marvelous. By the way, it's such an intriguing thing that your particular chapter, of which you are president, is Chapter B-O, and that various chapters have a two-letter distinction. So one chapter might be A-L, and another might be C-T or something like that. Explain to our listeners what that system is. It's really interesting.
It is, and incredibly unique. And that does go back to those seven founding sisters. So I believe, I'd like to think, that they did envision an organization greater than just the seven of them starting there at Iowa Wesleyan. And so their way of identifying that we're the first group of women to come together is they gave themselves the letter A. We're in Chapter A. And I'm not sure which of those seven came up with this brilliant idea of subsequent chapters could then be named following the letters of the alphabet, but that's what they did until they got to the end of the alphabet and recognized now we're at Z. They looped back to A and started all over again, adding the second letter to be the following letter in the alphabet. So the naming convention, as you just described, Greg, is once we've gotten through the alphabet A through Z, we go back to AA, AB, AC, so on and so forth. So you can see that today, as we're Chapter BO, where we fall in the scheme of how many chapters have been formed, and we're celebrating our 65th anniversary this year. We are into the D's here in Wisconsin, and we actually just had two chapters in Milwaukee who had gotten very small and unable to support a chapter themselves. They are now merging, so now we have a chapter that's going to be four letters but with a hyphen.
Ah.
So does that not speak to today's naming conventions as well, right? Taking two names and hyphenating them?
I like that a lot. Could you envision a scenario in which someday, in a sense, PEO does not need to do this anymore on behalf of women because things have become so equal that or in a sense, would that sort of betray the reason it was created in the first place? And is there always a reason for you to be doing what you're doing? I think you probably understand the implications of my question, because this organization was created at a time and in a sense in a world in which so many doors were closed to women, and we do not live in that same world. However, we still live in a world in which there are still issues about access. And so what difference does that make in terms of what PEO does?
I regretfully say I think it will definitely be needed long into the future, long past my lifetime, until we can be very proud of and recognize all the achievements that have happened over the course of the 150 years. But in reality, it's very slow, and barriers still exist, and challenges, at least financially, will probably always be one of those very difficult stumbling blocks that, regardless of gender, will always be an issue in achieving an education. But for women and other aspects of their lives, probably even more of a challenge. Mm-hmm. So I do think it will continue. I think one of our challenges going forward will be continuing to make sure that as an organization, we are reaching out and meeting the needs of our younger women and encouraging them to continue in the PEO spirit, to give back and constantly think about how to keep this journey going in a way that supports great-great-grandchildren in the future.
Hmm. Nancy Ritana, tell us why you are glad to be part of PEO, because I'm sure that it extends well beyond the fact that, well, they gave me this wonderful scholarship. I suspect that, I mean, you wouldn't be here today if that's all that this was about.
Like, you know, the whole point of this organization is sisterhood. And when I went to that meeting where I got my scholarship check, I just saw the sisterhood, the bond. Like, it's just a group of wonderful women in the community who are meeting for a sole purpose, and that's just for the greater good of the community. And I think, you know, as a woman, there's always that you have to, the breaking of the glass ceiling. You know, that's always going to be something that we all strive for professionally, socially, and whatnot, too. And I just think PEO just stands for all the great, great good that women can do for the community and for ourselves. You know, it's just a, like I said, great support system. I've met women that, you know, like, have done great things in the community. Like I said, my past elementary school teacher is now my sister. My former boss is now also my sister. And just, you know, have forged these great bonds and whatnot, too. It's just been great. And I know, like, if I ever move on or move to a different location, there's always going to be that sisterhood that I can always fall back on. So I'm honored to have been asked to be a part of the organization, and I just hope I can continue to just meet that whole mission goal and celebrating the advancement of women and just, you know, motivating each other and just moving forward. And like Teddy said, the world changes, so we just need to adapt. And I think myself, I think I'm kind of an example of how the organization will move forward. You know, I'm like the first Latina, I think, in the Kenosha chapter, in the BO chapter. So I just hoped I can continue that and recruit and whatnot, too, and just grow, help the organization grow and thrive.
Wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. Teddy, if people have questions about PEO, want to seek out more information, does the organization have a website, or are there other means by which they can get more information?
Absolutely. We do have a website. Also on Facebook. That is one of the areas in which, much to our delight, they've actually are very active on social media, which is wonderful. But we are at peointernational.org, and that gives a very nice overview of all of the projects. So even if there are women who find this could possibly be a resource for them financially, it'd be a way for them to tap into what the project descriptions are and the kinds of funding requirements that are make a person eligible. And they could then be matched with a chapter in their state or in their area so that we could get to know them better and find an opportunity to support them. Or for women who say, gee, this is just something I'd be very interested in learning more about, the same prospect would occur. They could contact all of our information will be on those on the website for each of the areas of the state. And then we invite them to learn more about us and get to know us. And we have an social events where we do encourage women to, we invite other women to become a part of the evening event to learn a little more about us. And one of those will be coming up this summer for us on July 23rd for Twilight Jazz in the Park at Kemper Center.
Right.
So one of our members lives very near across the street, so we're able to set up a picnic in her front yard and listen to the wonderful jazz music while still having our camaraderie and meeting time and to meet other women and talk and be connected that way. So that's one of the events where we invite other women to join us.
Fantastic. Teddy Winnett is the current president of one of the local chapters of PEO, and Nancy Ritana, a member and a grateful recipient of one of the PEO project's scholarships. It has been great to have you here and to hear more about the terrific story of PEO. Very best wishes and happy anniversary to both of you, and thank you for being part of the morning show.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. As we consider some of the most serious questions that involve the safety of our planet and the well-being of those who live on it, we can't forget the very important issue of controlling nuclear warheads, nuclear weapons. And sometimes, in light of other concerns that generate headlines, this is sometimes a concern that is perhaps a bit forgotten. We want to talk for the next few minutes about the treaty that exists between the United States and Russia, and the fact that the United States and Russia, between them, possess about 90% of the world's some 15,000 nuclear warheads. And there is the possibility that the nuclear treaty that exists between the two nations will not be extended upon its expiration in the year 2021. And it's important to think about what this might look like and what this could potentially mean for the world. My guest, Vincent Manso, is a research scientist with CNA, a nonprofit research organization. And he has been doing some exploration of some of these questions and joins me to talk about this. And Vincent Manso, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, explain to our listeners what this current treaty that is in place called New START does. What kind of limitations or controls does it place upon the United States and Russia?
Sure. So it sets numeric limits on the number of nuclear warheads each country has deployed on long-range missiles and bombers. So it sets those limits, and then it provides a verification regime that allows each country to gather information about the other's forces to ensure and make informed judgments that it's complying with the treaty. So what it does is help both countries have confidence that they understand what the other's nuclear arsenal looks like, that they understand in turn that their own forces remain sufficient for meeting their defense objectives and protecting themselves and their allies. And will continue to do so into the future because they know that year, 2 years, 3 years down the line, the other country will still be under the treaty as long as it's in force. So really it's about building confidence between the United States and Russia.
When was this treaty put into place?
So this treaty entered into force in 2011, and it was actually replacing the original START treaty that entered into force in 1994 and expired in December 2009. So really been a long time that the United States and Russia have been under a treaty that limits and provides transparency into long-range nuclear weapons.
Right. And is it a fairly typical nuclear agreement? I mean, does it bear strong resemblance to other treaties that exist perhaps between the United States and other countries?
So it's unique to the U.S.-Russia relationship, and it really does build on its predecessor treaty, the START treaty, which at the time was a major breakthrough in nuclear arms control in terms of the limits it set and the deep intrusive verification regime it put in place to give each country confidence that the other was complying with its treaty obligations. So I would say it's we're at a point where it's become typical in U.S.-Russian relations, but it really kind of marks a high point for nuclear arms control and sets a standard, really a standard for what we should expect out of an arms control agreement if we are going to have one.
Right. Your study raises the possibility that New START might not be extended when it expires in 2021. Is this a realistic possibility or significant possibility that we should be concerned about? And what are the signals or the signs that such a thing is possible? That is, that this treaty might, in fact, not be extended when it reaches expiration?
Well, right now, the U.S. government does not formally, has not made a decision on whether it wants to extend the treaty as of yet. And so that's the biggest one, is that the United States and our leadership might decide that it does not serve U.S. national interest to extend the New START treaty. But even if they do extend it, there's the challenge. It will eventually expire in 2026, and so the United States and Russia would need to agree upon another treaty to replace it and continue out into the future. And while that seems like a long way away, it'll come soon, and there are some real obstacles to negotiating a follow-on treaty, in that Russia wants the next treaty to cover U.S. Missile defense systems, which are designed to defend against another country's missiles. And the United States wants the next treaty to cover shorter-range nuclear weapons in Europe. Russia's got a lot of short-range nuclear systems in Europe that the United States would like to see covered under a treaty regime. And currently, there's a bit of an impasse because neither country neither country is willing to limit the systems the other country wants to limit.
Right. If this were not to be extended or renewed, if New START was allowed to expire in 2021, what would the ramifications of that be? I mean, what kind of situation then would we be looking at?
So the ramifications would be that the United States would have less insight and less confidence about its assessments of Russian nuclear forces. Russia would no longer have a limit on the number of nuclear long-range nuclear weapons it can deploy, and it has the ability to exceed the New START treaty limits by hundreds if it chooses to do so in deployed nuclear warheads. And so you could see a future where we have less insight, we revert back to kind of worst-case planning about what we think Russia's doing with its nuclear arsenal, and the overall size of Russia's deployed force increases, and potentially the United States could also increase the size of its deployed nuclear arsenal if it was no longer under legally binding limits. So my concern would be that you end up in a world where there's more suspicion and fear between the United States and Russia on nuclear issues and a more intense arms competition than we've currently seen in the last 10 to 20 years.
What about the presence of the great power of China, which we've not yet mentioned in this conversation, in such a scenario with the presence of China? Would that likely exacerbate that situation you just described?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So China has a much smaller nuclear force, but it's modernizing it. It's increasing its size modestly, and it's really developing much more sophisticated forces. And our concern is that if you get out into a future where the United States and Russia have no treaty limit in place, it could create additional pressure for China to continue expanding its nuclear force as well. And currently, the United States and China have no real cooperative relationship to manage that and deal with that situation. So it's another risk factor that we'd have to think about.
If this treaty were allowed to expire, are there other means by which arms control can happen in any kind of significant way? Are there other options available to us?
Yes, and that's what we looked at in our study. We tried to find some imperfect substitutes for a nuclear arms control treaty. So the most immediate option would be that the United States and Russia could make a commitment to stay at the numeric level set by the New START treaty, even if that treaty is no longer in place. I think there's an alignment of it would be in both countries' interest to do that because both face some real risks and uncertainties if they get out into this world where they're both increasing the size of their force. The United States and Russia could also continue to exchange data about their deployed force levels. They could continue, as they do under the treaty, and they could continue to provide notifications when they make changes in their deployed force levels. Under New START, both countries provide 48-hour notification before additional ballistic missiles leave their production facilities. They could continue to do that so that the other could then position its national technical means for intelligence gathering to observe that. So there's a number of things that we could do. I think they would be effective, and certainly they'd be better than no cooperation at all. I don't think they would be as effective and as give as much confidence as an actual treaty does, however. So that's one of the reasons we conclude in the report that the United States and Russia should extend the New START treaty out to 2026 and give themselves more time to figure out what comes next.
Is it possible for members of the general public to read your report in its entirety? Is it available?
Yes, absolutely. It's available on the CNA website, which is www.cna.org.
Very good. Well, we would encourage people to seek that out and read further on this important topic. Vincent Manzo is a research scientist with CNA and primary author of this research report. Vincent Manzo, we appreciate you joining us on The Morning Show. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Monday on The Morning Show, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist from the Denver Post and his fascinating book about a largely forgotten story from World War II, a book called The Storm on Our Shores. The Morning Show is now available as a podcast, and you can subscribe via Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. And if you are a subscriber to the Morning Show podcast, then you can hear a very special treat for tomorrow, namely a conversation that I recorded about 10 years ago with one of the greatest legends of television comedy, Carl Reiner. We recorded our interview on the publication